Okay, just saw that because we got to write endeavour, just haven't started it yet. So we do endeavour to score up. There we go.
Can I ask a question before we start?
Well, I'm saying thing, yeah. Go on.
So, in the right action,
yeah,
or the sexual misconduct,
yeah,
you didn't mention anything about sex before marriage. Well, in the original text, the Buddha said something about being under the protection of mother, father, and...
Indeed, yes. So, in protection of mother and father was just the way... you did not have the right of consent. So the parents had that consent for you. In the same way that you had to ask your parents' permission to get married. But in most places now, it's 18, sometimes even as low as 16 in some places, that you can decide to marry this person or that person. So there's nothing there about sex before marriage at all, being something which is sexual misconduct. So in and of itself, if it is permitted in that jurisdiction, then there is it's not deemed to be sexual misconduct in terms of the wrong livelihood. However, just because it's not in the rules, it doesn't mean that it's a good thing to do. There's nothing in there about watching pornography on the internet. The Buddha never mentioned that. So it doesn't mean it's okay to do. So I think you get the point. So right endeavour. What now is right endeavour? There are these four right endeavours: restraint, abandonment, development and preservation. Now, before we go further, just a couple of it, is, you know that it's usually translated as right effort or right striving. That, to me, never really made too much sense. And if you look at what the four things actually are, it's restraint, abandonment, which is all not a striving but a letting go, and even development and preservation. You will find out that it's through the letting go, through establishing things like kindness. It is by the effort to say no, the effort to stop, the effort to abandon, which is not really an effort. It's something which is a little bit different. You don't try to let go, you let go of trying. So that's why I'm trying to come up with a word, you know, which is shows that you know you are actually not just indulging in what your normal habits are. You are stopping, you are letting go, which is an effort, but not the effort which people usually understand as such. So anyway, change it to right endeavour. And the first, the endeavour of restraint. What is the endeavour of restraint? When you see an object, you do not allow, you do not let yourself get sucked in by the marks and features that generate defilements. I did mention that briefly this morning, that in order to control lust, in order to let go of just whatever you see in the shops you want to buy, you know, what happens there? You see something and you get sucked in there. Please remember that shopkeepers or anyone who's into sales has to position the product, the smells, the environment, which try and suck you in to make you feel that you really need to buy that thing. And even today when the monks were asking me, oh, these shells are really, really going cheap because it's a friend of a friend. So, can we get these shells? I said, well, do you need them? I said, but they're cheap. And I replied to them the story that this fellow, he came to temple in Nolamara one afternoon with his big, is it plasma screen, LCD TV, whatever, you know, the big TVs. I don't go shopping, so I don't know their name. So, whatever they're called. And he said, do you want one for the temple? I said, no, we don't watch TV. He said, but it's a new one. brand new, good quality. Well, why do you want to give it to us if you just bought it? He said, well, I don't need it. I only bought it because it was on sale. And maybe you can understand that logic, but I can't. The only reason he purchased it, because it was a bargain. But he didn't need it, that's why he's trying to get rid of it. And I thought, this is crazy stuff. So, well, you see something, it was the price, which was a bargain. You had to buy it. It was the colours, you know, the way it's advertised. You have to buy it, you have to get it. By the way, they did tell me that it's important so they can actually make use of it. So I did give my okay. But, for the shelves. But no, but that's why we buy these things. We just get sucked into it. We generate the defilements that I really want this, so I don't like that person. If it's an enemy of yours, you see, straight away you look at that part of him or her, which, you know, just arouses what you want to see in them. Maybe if you're afraid of them, their big tattoos and their bushy beard, and that's just the girls. Are you joking? But that you get slapped in by marks and features that generate defilements. Since you've left the faculty of sight unrestrained, unskillful states of wanting and aversion would afflict you. Instead, you practice wisdom when seeing. You guard the faculty of sight, you understand and take the restraint of sight. So, you know, when you see something in the shops, you don't just look at how beautiful it is, you look at the price tag. You know, can you afford it? Do I really need it? How long is this going to last? So, advertising, sales, you always put the marks and features in there to try and generate the desire to buy the things which you don't really need. So, you practice restraint. Having heard a sound, a smell, a sense of taste, felt a bodily feeling, cognize something in the mind, you do not let yourself get sucked in by the marks and features that generate defilements. Since you've left the mind faculty unrestrained, unskillful states of wanting and aversion would afflict you. Instead you practice wisdom with the mind. You guard the mind and undertake the restraint of the mind. It's called the endeavor to restrain. So this is actually use your wisdom to look at something. If it's something you really, really have a desire for, sounds you like, smells which you like, whatever it is, then you try and see the negative part, the dangers. It's the same as if you are getting lost in a train of thinking. You know, you have to not get sucked into it, but stand back from it. The simile, which I should have said this morning when I was talking about the hindrances. But why is it that when you watch a TV program or you watch a movie, why do you get sucked into it? Sometimes it's just the music sucks you in. It controls your emotions. The wind is something very scary. Or whatever it is. And when, I think it still happens, when it's a romance, the violins come out. And there's certain music which controls your emotions. So if you turn the music off, or even turn off the dialogue when you watch a movie, it's a totally different experience. So, this is some way you can, you know, learn to restrain yourself getting sucked into silly things like movies. Or like sports matches, which is just total suffering. It's one of the reasons I became a monk. When you're watching these football matches, which people in England were just so caught up in. I think there was one match I remember when I was a school teacher. It was a World Cup qualifying match, and the English soccer team only needed to draw to qualify for the next level, and they lost. Someone's got to lose. But the next day, everyone was depressed at the school I was teaching in. Even the teachers, there was no discipline problems, no kids were messing around, they were all sitting there, really depressed. And sometimes I was wishing the soccer team would lose every day. They're so easy to teach. And he was, this is crazy. It's only a football match. But, you know, you get sucked in to the signs and the features, which means it makes you depressed. So this is where we learn how to restrain our senses by not getting sucked in, using wisdom power, not willpower. So you get stupid thoughts, you don't try and stop them, willpower. What you do, you understand them. And you see that it's the features which you don't want to get sucked in anymore. But to abandon, what is the effort to abandon? He did not maintain the reason thought of wanting. You abandon it, let go, renounce it, bring it to cessation. You abandon it, you let it go, renounce it. You don't kick butt. If you want to kick butt, join the US Marines, not the Buddhist meditators. You do not indulge in the reason thought of aversion, the reason thought of harming. Whenever bad unwholesome states arise, you abandon them, let them go, renounce them and bring them to the cessation. This is called the effort to abandon. When you are marked with some object and the rising new fleeting unwholesome thoughts connecting with desire, aversion, delusion, then these are the ways of overcoming them. The last one is quite aggressive. But you don't beat down a person, you just, you know, just restrain the thoughts. So anyway, number one, you give attention to some other object that generates wholesome mind states. Thus unwholesome states of abandonment subside. With their disappearance, your mind becomes internally steady, settled, unified and still. So it's called the substitution method. That's one of the reasons why when we meditate we start with the body, because the body's our feelings and sensations are important to our health and well-being. If we don't get ourselves in a good posture to begin with, it's going to be painful later on. So it's an incentive there to be with your bodily feelings. And that substitutes, you know, the silly thoughts, past and future, or fantasies which people indulge in. You substitute that with something really important, feeling the body, how are you? And also that if you are get lost in all these silly thoughts, you go out into the forest and you feel the warmth of the sun, you feel the wind on your skin, you take off your sandals and socks and you feel the cold or the texture of the surface on which you're walking. That is actually substituting something which is real, imminent and wholesome instead of just getting lost in stupid thoughts. It's a substitution. If that doesn't work, you should examine the danger in those unwholesome thoughts. Where are they going to lead to if you keep on going on like that? Number one, this retreat can end so quickly, and all you've ever done is fantasize and dream and write your biography and prepare all the stuff which you're going to do when you have to go home, and you're wasting your time. There was one monk, I won't say who he is, but he became quite well known. And he was with one of these monks who could read your mind. They would do a 2-hour meditation every morning. And it was really hard, you know, he was a Westerner. Really hard, you know, some days he didn't sleep much, and it was hot weather, humid, in the jungles. And, you know, eating not very wholesome food. And this poor monk would always struggle every morning, the 2-hour meditation. But one morning, when he got up to do the 2-hour meditation early in the morning, in front of everybody, with everybody else, he started to have a sexual fantasy. He started to think of girls and romance and stuff. And he said, for the first time in months, it was so easy to meditate. And the time flew by. But afterwards, when they ring the bell after the 2-hour sleep, he said, oh, what will happen if the head monk had read my mind? And he felt so guilty and scared. And when the head monk got up from his seat and walked right towards him and loomed over him, oh my goodness, he's been reading my mind. And he had. And all he said was, you've just been wasting your time. And that's all. And then he walked off. That was compassionate, not sort of scolding him. You know, it's your karma. You waste your time. So do you really want to do that? He said, that's a wonderful little way of describing how kind teachers, they don't shout at you, scold you. They just say what it really is. Just a waste of time. So you're a monk, what are you doing that for? So you examine the danger in those unwholesome thoughts. So be careful. How many of you have been wasting your time? Anyway, the third, you should try to ignore those unwholesome thoughts and do not give attention to them. Which is another one, just ignoring them. They come up and just turn off to something else, ignore them. Don't give them value. People often give value to thoughts, believing they can give you solutions to the problems of life. You think the matter through. And how many have you noticed that you think, and you still don't get a solution, you just get tired. But if you put it aside and just relax, be peaceful, then after a few days of meditating or being peaceful, the solutions come to you. It's the wisdom born of silence. Silence can see much deeper than thinking can ever reach. So that can be put on one of those bags you want to make. Another question. So that is where don't give them value, which allows you to ignore them. Other things are more important, stillness in particular. Or you should give attention to studying the causes of those thoughts. Why are you thinking so much? That was always a very powerful one to me. It's, why am I thinking so much? Why can't I be still? Because I was afraid of stillness. I didn't really know what stillness was. It was like unfamiliar territory. And my comfort zone was thinking. That's what I was encouraged to do. So, studying the causes of those thoughts, I always blamed my school teachers when I was very young. I remember my late name was Peter, and they used to say, Peter, what do you think about that? And I said, nothing. And they thought I was stupid. I could have been a great monk much earlier. So sometimes we're encouraged to think. So here, the causes of thoughts. You don't have to think. And a lot of times escaping instead of just facing up to this moment. We find this moment is much more pleasant than you ever expected. Or lastly, you should clench your teeth with your tongue pressed against the roof of the mouth and beat down, constrain and crush any such a bit in the house of thoughts. That's really the last resort, which often doesn't work, with all respect to the great Buddha. But what it does, it just stops you acting on those thoughts. If you think, I'm going to go to Ajahn Brahm's room this evening, and I'm going to get the chainsaw out and just chainsaw off his head. Please, clench with your teeth, your tongue pressed against the roof of the mouth, and beat down those thoughts. Constrain them. Because sometimes we do need, it's really dangerous thoughts. You know, we do need a bit of extreme measures, but the others are far more effective. And endeavour to develop. What is endeavour to develop? Here you develop the enlightenment factor of mindfulness. These are the seven enlightenment factors. And that's in the recent conference which I was talking at in Toronto. It was, mindfulness played a huge part in that conference. But there's one thing which I always notice there, that people say how important mindfulness is, but very rarely they tell you how to be mindful. How can you be mindful and sustain that mindfulness for long enough for it to work? And you will find that willpower is not good enough. You can't make yourself mindful. Number one, you get exhausted, and number two, you just get frustrated and disappointed. You can't manage it. You don't just make it happen, you've got to learn how to do it. And what are the causes of mindfulness? And one of the greatest causes of mindfulness is stillness. When you're still, it's so easy to be mindful for long periods of time. And also, the other cause of stillness is joy. If I tell a few jokes and funny stories, you want to come and stay here. If I'm boring, you'll go out the door and leave. If I upset you and offend you again, then you will leave. But if I make it fun and kind, people love to stay. It shows you how mindfulness depends on joy and stillness and kindness. So you endeavor to develop, as you know the courses, you put them in place and the mindfulness comes with it, comes to you. Sometimes, if you're very sleepy, you get more mindful when you turn down the temperature of the room, you take off your jackets, you're more alive because the heat makes you drowsy, so you go aside and sleep. Or just like this monastery in Laos before I became a monk, and I just, when I became a monk, the Vietnam War was still on, and very close to Laos where our monastery was, and so we had many Laotian monks who would come over and they'd tell us what the practices were in Laos before the communist takeover in Laos. And there was this one monastery which was very famous. Many great monks came from this monastery. And when you were a young monk, the teacher would take you on a walk through the jungle in the hills, the really steep hills. All day walking up and down these hills, and all hot until you were totally exhausted, but pretty exhausted. And did you go for a walk today? Yeah, there we go. So he was following that old tradition, but he didn't show you the parts where in this particular forest there was in really tall trees, huge giant trees, and the high branches, they had built a little platform just the size of one of these meditation mats. They had a bamboo ladder, so you can climb up that ladder and sit on these little platforms high up in the trees. So all these monks, after having a walk and getting exhausted, they had to climb up and sit on these little mats, or platforms made out of bamboo. No railings on them at all. And then the teacher would take the ladder away, good night, I'll be back in the morning. So there you were sitting. Did you do that? Show the photo. Tomorrow. Anyone who goes to walk tomorrow. And there you were sitting so high up, you couldn't climb down. There's only one way up and down. Actually, the main way up and down was the ladder. And there's two ways down. Wait for the monk to come in the morning or fall to your death. And if you get injured, the tigers and other animals will eat you all up. So you didn't have much choice there. You know, you're sitting up there and you had to be mindful. It's a bit extreme, but it worked. Apparently many great meditators came out of that tradition. But of course we don't hear about those who fell off. They didn't talk about those. So, you develop mindfulness, exploring the Dhamma. And some people ask, what does that actually mean? Sometimes they call it contemplating the Dhamma, but contemplating is too much thinking. What I mean by exploring, this is... What is this I'm holding up?
Water bottle.
Yeah, what else?
Plastic.
Plastic, what else? Yeah, come on, what else can you see?
Paper.
What else? Keep going. What else?
Dihydrogen monoxide.
That's exploring. Contemplating, naming, think about it, just give it a name. It's a water bottle. Yeah, you've done it, completed it. You don't think about it anymore. You don't even look at it anymore. Finish, done. That's why people go to see the Dhamma. First impressions, they see something else, a water bottle, done. And they go to something else. To explore the Dhamma, you take it. And you are mindful and sustain that mindfulness on it. So it goes right in and sees things which you haven't been taught before. I gave that simile at when I gave the keynote address at the 2015 World Computer Congress. And they asked, what the heck am I doing there? And I said, I'm teaching how to innovate. And I did that simile. So what's I'm holding up? They all said, water bottles. look more, see more. Because in an industry like computing, you have to be ahead of the game, you have to innovate. You have to see what other people have to see. So that's how it works. That's how I call exploring the Dhamma. And invite the fountain of energy. Once you start exploring the Dhamma with mindfulness, and again, just calm, the mindfulness gives you this incredible energy. You become still and you're energized. And when you have energy, you have rapture. When you have rapture, this is incredible joy. It's much easier to have a calm body when you are enjoying yourself. I used to think, we used to do these all night sits when I was a young monk. I used to get so tired and sleepy during those all night sits, so bored. But as a young monk, I contemplated only 12 months before then, I was a lay person. And I used to go to all night concerts, all night parties. And you know, at an all night party, I never felt tired or drowsy. I thought, what's the difference? I'm not sleeping because I was enjoying myself. I had joy when you listen to a concert or an all-night party. But because I had no joy, that's where the energy was lost. So the energy and the rapture go together, and also the tranquility. When you're having fun, you can sit here for hours. And then stillness comes from tranquility, and from stillness, the equanimity. So every one of which is based upon seclusion, physical and mental. Seclusion means you're going away from things. When you meditate, you don't engage with others. You just find a nice little seclusion for yourself. You've all learned how to be with other people. And have you learned to be with yourself? Or rather with your no-self? And just learn how just to be. And go inside, it's very calm and peaceful. So those who endeavour to develop is fading away, cessation, maturing, and release. The effort to maintain. What is the endeavour to maintain? Here you keep in mind, and there is a meditation object that generates stillness, such as we're collecting the Buddha, like I did this morning. I don't know if I've got any feedback whether that worked or not, but for some people, I've got a few thumbs up. It's only two, so I work for two people, so the rest of you is just a waste of time. No. But what that does, you recollected the Buddha, you imagined you were a Buddha, you're a play act. Because I wasn't a great actor when I was at school, but every now and again you remembered, you had to really get into the role. You know, you imagine you were Hamlet. And Hamlet just really sort of mentally tormented, so you had to become mentally tormented. And apparently I did read an article about, was it Robert De Niro, I think, an actor? He was playing a role in Oliver Sacks' Awakenings. I remember reading the book about these people who had a very bad virus and they went into a coma for years. And this Oliver Sacks was experimenting with all sorts of stuff and they suddenly woke up out of the coma for many, many years. And it was such an amazing book and someone made a movie of it. I never saw the movie. But Robert De Niro was playing one of the roles of, I think, one of these people who was really sick. And Oliver Sacks was a consultant. And Oliver Sacks got really scared one day because he hadn't told Robert De Niro what all the symptoms were, just some of the symptoms. And this was such an amazing actor. He was living the role so much that apparently his feet started to point in. And that was one of the symptoms, unnaturally pointing, and that was one of the symptoms of this disease. He was actually getting into the role so much, he was actually exhibiting symptoms of the disease which Oliver Sacks had never told him about. It was scary. So that was this idea of, you know, just imagining you're a Buddha, really role-playing, getting into the persona of a Buddha, what you think it is. And there was some characteristics which you don't really know about what the Buddha was, you start to feel them, the stillness, the peace. So that means it gives you a head start in meditation. So, or Dhamma, or the Sangha, or a skeleton, or loving kindness, or the breath, or a nimitta, these beautiful lights in the mind. In the skeleton things, it's weird, but I never really get into skeletons. But you know, some monks do that, and it's usually just the skull. I do, if you've been to my cave, you look in my room, there's an old skull there. It's about 200 or 300 years old, that skull. And I put it in there, in my room, just to keep out burglars. And I think that's a wonderful way of a burglar alarm, really cheap. You know, if you want to cut down on the costs of the insurance, in your house in Hong Kong or apartments or in Jakarta, just get an old skull, just put it on the end of a stick. If a thief comes in and it rattles, that's far better than having another alarm system there. The thief will run away. But anyway, some monks do that. And what actually happens is, you know, you visualize a skeleton. And it's supposed to be, it's supposed to be for realizing that's all people are. You know, just bones and a bit of skin and stuff. But after a while, it gives you so much peace and stillness that your mindfulness really increases, and the skull starts to glow, starts to fluoresce. It turns into this beautiful glowing limiter. That's actually what happens. Loving kindness is a better limiter. This is the endeavor to maintain. Restraining and abandoning, developing and maintaining, these four endeavors were taught by the Buddha. By this means, a diligent meditation in this very life can attain the destruction of suffering. And the extra story, the extra anecdote to that, after 5 years as a monk, you know, you're actually encouraged to just go touring around, visit other teachers, so you don't just, you know, become a clone of Ajahn Chah, or just like Venerable Mudita just recently spent, I don't know, 3 months or 6 months at India, 3 months over there, just, you know, just get out and just see, you know, life outside of Bodhinyana Monastery. That's encouraged to get a much more wider understanding. So one of the things I did was go and see one of the great monks, Ajahn Mahabua, check him out. So when I was staying with him, he didn't understand just how much I understood Thai at the time, so he gave a talk. And he said, this is for the Western monk who just came in. And that was when he said one of the anecdotes. If you remember Ajahn Mahabua, a very tough monk, and he said one of the anecdotes from the time he was a student of Ajahn Man, that was also Ajahn Chah's teacher, and Ajahn Mahabua had a fever. He was malaria fever. That's almost all the monks had malaria in those days. And in the middle of a fever, when the bell went for the chores in the temple, in the monastery, he wasn't going to just let the fever control him. He had such incredible strong willpower, this monk. So he got up, shaking and sweating, put on some robes, and managed to get down the stairs of his hut, pick up a broom, and do battle with the fever, sweeping, doing his jobs, even though he was in the middle of a malaria fever. He was tough. And when Ajahn Mun saw him, he just scolded him, "That's not the way of a Buddhist monk." Now, he used to be an amateur boxer before. "You just haven't changed at all. You're still a boxer, Mahabua." And he said, "A Buddhist monk does not fight. A Buddhist monk investigates. Go up to your hut and investigate the illness, but don't fight it." And coming from, you know, the mouth of Ajahn Mahabua, who was a great fighter, you know, that was just very important for me. So that is the endeavor, to understand the problems, not to fight them. And if any of you know those teachings of suttas, it was always Mara was the embodiment of stupidity. And Mara would come to try and stop people from achieving enlightenment. And the only way to overcome Mara was not by fighting Mara, but the monk, the nun, the lay meditator would say, "I know you, Mara." And then Mara would go away. Through understanding, you defeated Mara. not through aggression. That's a very important part of Buddhism. We don't fight the defilements. We understand them and thereby overcome them. Just like in the Chinese art of war, Sungpo, know your enemy, know yourself. 1,000 battles fought, 1,000 battles won. Remember that one? You probably heard it in a movie like I did years ago, but I never read the book. Sorry?
Oh, you know, it's probably 100
battles won, not 1,000.
Not 1,000.
Okay, well, you always, stories always exaggerate. Anyway, that was the right endeavour. So remember what we've done so far. We've done the right view to set the ground, the plan, and then the right motivation, where you're coming from, the actions of speech, actions, livelihood, and the endeavour, just know how we actually do this stuff, and then we get to the mindfulness and then the stillness. So the right mindfulness, and it's always the four foundations of mindfulness. A foundation doesn't really just have much of information with it. What is a foundation? Maybe you build buildings, you know, a foundation. But the focus of mindfulness, because it's where you put that mindfulness, what you're mindful of. And, you know, the four foundations of mindfulness are on the body, on experience, on the mind and the mind objects. Why is that? It's because those are the four things, especially the first three, where people think there's a self. That's where they think they exist. That's what they think they control and own. Their body, their experience, their mind, and these objects of mind. So anyway, the four focuses of mindfulness lead in one direction only, to the purification of beings, to going beyond sadness and crying, instead of lamentation. Now that, you know what lamentation means, it means crying. So why do you say just crying instead of this word which hardly anyone uses? Now when you're really upset you say, oh, I was lamentating this evening. You say crying. So, but it leads in one direction only. It is so mischievous, I think is the word, for monks to say an only path. It doesn't say that. Anyone who's a Pali scholar knows it doesn't mean that at all. It can't mean that. It doesn't make any sense. It means a path going in one direction only. It doesn't mean the only path. To prefer purification of beings, to go beyond sadness and crying, disappearance of physical and mental suffering. That's what we're supposed to be doing. Mental suffering and physical suffering disappearing, yay! For the term of the true way for the realization of Nirvana. What are the four? Having restrained the five hindrances, you abide aware of the body, energized, knowing the purpose of what you're doing and mindful. Having restrained the five hindrances, you abide aware of experience, Vedana, energized, knowing the purpose of what you're doing and mindful. Having restrained the five hindrances, you abide aware of the mind, energized, knowing the purpose of what you're doing and mindful. Having restrained the five hindrances, you abide aware of mind objects, energized, knowing the purpose of what you're doing and mindful. That is my preferred translation. Makes a lot of sense. Where you have probably got used to the phrase, having abandoned covetousness and, what's that one? Grief for the world. Which, people don't have grief for the world. They have grief for their grandma who passed away. They may have grief that Donald Trump got elected. But grief for the world. And it doesn't mean that. So it means having restrained the five hindrances. Now it starts to make sense that these five hindrances, like I've been talking, wanting, aversion and the resulting tiredness and the restlessness and the doubt, that those are what stop you seeing the truth and stop you being calm. So you restrain those things and then you can be mindful of these things. You know, you see deeply into them. How on earth can you be mindful when you're not really aware of what's happening over here? You're just, you know, planning where you want to be in a few minutes' time. You're not here, you're not aware. Or if, you know, that you refuse to admit what's really in front of your eyes, like that scientist who couldn't see the flower pot rising because it was just too challenging for him. So this is where restraining the five hindrances allows you to be mindful. And it is, could you squat up again, please? This is energized. You need energy to be mindful. There's five hindrances. When they're abandoned, it gives you a boost of energy. And knowing the purpose of what you are doing. Now that is also important when you are practicing mindfulness. And the story I was telling, that some years ago in Vietnam, in another conference, I like going to conferences and get lots of interesting stories, see different ways of doing things. And in this, it was General Thich Nhat Hanh was at the conference. I was sitting next to him, trying to engage him in a conversation, but he was too mindful to speak to me. That was a bit cheeky. But he brought a lot of his disciples with him. And at a conference, you know, you have the main speakers and the themes, then you have a breakout session, they call it. So people join different groups for the different themes. And they always elect, you know, a leader, you know, to actually, to guide the conversation, you know, of all the people there, make sure that people can contribute, and also to take notes to report back to the whole meeting afterwards. So on one of these subjects, you know, was one of the senior Western teachers of Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, was the convener there, taking notes, keeping it on track, and then reporting back to everybody afterwards. So, when it came time for her to give the report, the MC said, and now report on, say, Buddhism and technology, or whatever it was. Now invite, whatever her name was, to please go to the lectern to give the report. And the teacher was there right in front of her, so she rose up from her chair, really mindful, noticing every movement of her feet. And then she walked, noticing the first part of the foot which lifted up off the ground, the last part, and all the different feelings as one foot moved up and then moved forward. And then finally met the carpet, and as the weight turned from one foot to another. And by the time she reached the lectern, the MC said, "Time's over." And it's no exaggeration, that happened, I saw it. And that was where, know the purpose of what you're doing. It's okay to walk slowly if you got the time, but if other people are waiting for you, then you should walk a bit faster. You can walk faster and be mindful, but knowing the purpose of what you're doing and mindful. That's the Sampajanya part. Mindful and fully aware. I said fully aware, that's again just a translation which makes no sense. It means the purpose. Why are you doing this? So, then mindfulness of the body. And how are you aware of the body? And this is straight from the sutras. The mindfulness of breathing. You go to the wilderness or to the root of a tree, to a secluded place. Sit down, having folded your leg crosswise, set your body erect, your priority establishing mindfulness. So mindfully you breathe in, mindfully you breathe out. Straight away, you don't go to the forest. The idea of forest monks. It, the word is aranya. No, aranya, you know, another word, raja. Actually, in Bahasa, many Bahasa words are just similar to Pali. Like, so, I don't know, what is the word for wilderness in Bahasa?
Hutan.
Okay, no, so just gonna it's a nice, good try, but didn't work. But it literally means unruled. just basically not in the realm covered by the king or the government. It's a wilderness. So it's not just forest. Okay, in Southeast Asia, most of the wild places will be forest, but it also includes the mountains and the deserts. That's also Aranya. So the so-called forest monks, wilderness monks, will go away from like cities and people and live in wilderness areas. Or to the root of a tree, to a secluded place, sit down, having fold your legs crosswise, set your body erect. That's what they used to do. But even the Buddha under the Bodhi tree sat on a cushion. He gathered grass from the left over by the grass cutters. So it wasn't like ascetic, just sitting on broken glass or like those fakirs on those bed of nails. You actually make it comfortable. And give priority to establishing mindfulness. Where it says, some people translate, establish mindfulness in front of you. And in front of you. Now where is this you located? Because of Western conditioning, which people in Hong Kong are brought into, you know, we are in here. So in front of me must be in here somewhere. In my nose. That's where people start meditating on the breath in their nose. It doesn't mean that. But, you know, a long time ago in Asia, you know, this was where you were. And so it must be breathing in and out here. But breath doesn't mean that. In front of you. That's a translation which is, it could mean that, but it's quite obvious. It means give it priority. First on the list, the highest, right in the front. So you make mindfulness a priority first of all, which is one of the reasons why that when you meditate, I ask you to look at your posture first of all. Establish mindfulness, awareness, before you even start watching your breathing. Because it's a big mistake with people who meditate, they watch their breath too soon. And the only way they can maintain it is through force, which means they get samadhi headache. They get tense and it doesn't work. They use too much force. Use wisdom power. Establish a mindfulness. Relax first of all. Get in the present moment. Just be here. And then you can go watching the breath, but not too soon. Then mindful you breathe in, mindful you breathe out. When the in-breath and out-breath are long, you're aware they are long. When the in-breath and out-breath are short, you're aware they are short. Then you learn to experience the whole of the breath as you breathe in and out. Then you learn to calm the breath as you breathe in and out. Now, scroll up again, because sometimes, up. No, not that way, the other way. Very good, be mindful. Now, first of all, when a lot of people read those suttas, breathing in and in breath, you are aware that it's an in-breath, breathing out an in-breath, you are aware that it is long, breathing out this and breathing in that, and it's just so long that people lose focus. So just abbreviating just the instructions, when the in-breath and out-breath are long, you're aware they are long. The in-breath and out-breath are short, you're aware they are short. It makes it much easier, user-friendly. Then you learn to experience the whole of the breath as you breathe in and out. Many people, it says the whole body of the breath, but that confuses people to think you're aware of your physical body. But in Pali it doesn't mean the body. It means a body is a body of evidence in a court case, a body of soldiers. That word even in English is used. This means an accumulation of things. So experience of the whole of the breath as you breathe in and out means from the very beginning of the in-breath, all the different parts of an in-breath until the very end of the in-breath. Just like you experience the whole of one step when you're doing walking meditation, the first part which moves up from the ground as the whole foot departs from the floor and moves up and forward, 1,000 sensations in one step. So that's actually the whole of the step, the whole of the breath. Then you learn to calm the breath as you breathe in and out. Not through willpower, but just by being there, letting go, relaxing, and that calms your breath. Now, the next simile, which you may have come across before, just as a skilled lathe operator or his apprentice. When doing a short turn, knows it's a short turn, or a long turn, knows it's a long turn. And how many of you have operated a foot pedal lathe? None of you. So the simile doesn't make much sense. So, keep the essence of the simile and just give it something which people can understand. So I change it just as a skilled painter is aware whether making a long brush stroke or a short brush stroke. So too, when the invert is long, you're aware that it's long. So this is how we modernize the translations of the Buddha's teachings so it is relevant to your life. So this is not the final, but hopefully I can do something. So some of these teachings are so amazing that people just turn off because there's too much repetition, similes which are just so dated. And if you are translating, you translate the meaning, not the words. And you know the old simile, it was raining cats and dogs. And for someone who's never understood English before, they think this is a crazy place. Dogs and cats fall from the sky. And of course, that's not how you translate. It was just heavy rain. That's what it means. So you don't translate word by word, you translate the meaning. In this way, you're aware of your own body, you're aware that bodies of others are the same nature as yours, or you abide aware of the nature of both your own and others' bodies. Or else you abide aware of what causes the arising of the body, the four nutriments. And you abide that the body will cease when the four nutriments cease. Or you abide, contemplate the body's cause, the nature of both arising and ceasing. Some people, if they haven't had good instructions and they don't read the suttas themselves, they think it means rise and fall. You watch rise and fall. They think that's Satipatthana. It does not mean that. This is explained so clearly in the Samyutta, Satipatthana Samyutta, that it means the causes, why these things come up. And when those causes are gone, they disappear. And the four nutriments, we find those afterwards, but it's food, is the first one, obviously. If you don't eat, you're going to die. And then there's also like contact, experience. And that was actually fascinating, you know, even in medicine. If you don't have experience, sensory stimulation, a person dies. So a person may be in a coma. If you don't talk to them, you don't touch them, you don't give them some experience, Buddhist understanding means they will die. You need to be experienced to be able to keep on living. So it's one of the important points. If you do want your old grandma to come out of a coma, then stroke her hands, hold her hands, talk to her, even if you think that she can't hear you. By stimulating her senses, there's a good chance she will come out. Otherwise, without that stimulation experience, the contact, the cause for the existence of the body is taken away. And of course the other one is willpower. Will is an important nutriment, and that is why you see, again, a couple of doctors here, you know that sometimes people that are there in a hospital bed, they should be dead by now, but they keep going on until their daughter arrives from New York. And then once they arrive, then they start the death process. It's amazing how many times that happens. They keep going because of willpower. Or there's also those ones who get so depressed, they just give up the will to live. And they too pass away. So the will, wanting to continue, is important. If you take that away, you're dead. And the last one is consciousness. Without that, then, those are the four causes for the body. If those are taken away, then you die. So, that's a call for nature, both arising and ceasing, or else mindfulness that is just the body, impermanent suffering, and not me, not mine, not the self, is established in you, the extent necessary for mindfulness wisdom, and wisdom essential for liberation. Just a body, that's all. It's going to get sick, it's going to die. You know, don't worry about it too much. You know, if you don't like this one, the sooner you die, you can get a better model. Next time. No, honestly, why do people keep carrying on? Just, you know, is it really a good idea? You're just really old and sick and just, But anyway, you've got to make sure that, just like if you have a car, make sure that you've got good insurance. So if it does get wrecked, if it does wear out, then you can replace it. If you've got really good car insurance, you can get a better model next time. So insurance is another word for karma, good karma. So if you make lots of good karma, it means you don't have to worry. If this old body gets wrecked, you get a really good karma, and then, you know, you can be Daniel Richard Gere. You can be like Richard Gere, even more handsome than Richard Gere. Unfortunately, I don't know film stars. Who's the hot film star? The lady these days.
Lady?
Yeah. The female film star. I used to know Angelina Jolie, but apparently she's old now.
Gal Gadot.
Gal Gadot?
Yeah. Gal Gadot.
Gal Gadot, or whatever she is. But so you can be like Gal Gadot in your next life. You're so hot and so beautiful. Anyway. So that means you can be wise and abide independent, not clinging to anything in the world, especially bodily stuff. It's just a body, that's all. So it's not me, not mine, not a self. My body, everybody else's body, that's the nature. That's one way you're mindful of the body. Okay, it's 4:00 now, so it's time to finish on this before we do the four postures. So we're just starting off with the mindfulness. And hopefully, I'm not just teaching you what you already know, but teaching you something new, a different way of seeing things, which is really important. At the very end of the Satipatthana Sutta, you will read or you will hear, if you practice like this for 7 days, promised the Buddha, then you can be either fully enlightened or at least a non-returner. And I recall the first time I read the Satipatthana Sutta, an English translation by Bhikkhu Soma, a Sri Lankan monk. And I read that when I was still a student at university. And I was laughing my head off when I saw in the introduction, he said he went to Burma with another monk. He understood that if you practice Satipatthana for 7 days, you become fully enlightened, or at least a non-returner, you get something great. And so after about a month, he still hadn't got anything, so he said, well, I might as well write a book about it. But then, you don't doubt the Buddha's words. So if he said he can become enlightened in 7 days, and it's not working, is the Buddha lying? It doesn't lie. It means you haven't read the instructions. So read the instructions again, and find out why it's not 7 days. And the main thing was, you weren't restraining the 5 hindrances first. Abandoning grief and covetous for the world doesn't really cut it. Doesn't mean much. But when you really see this, restraining the 5 hindrances, and then it can be very amazing. But if you want something, the hindrances are having free reign. You never get anything. One of the hardest things to do, just to be still, be peaceful, not want anything. And then 6 days or 7 days. So who wants to go home? Back to Hong Kong, back to You're missing out. 7 days you could be an anagami, fully in mind. Do you want to cancel your flights?
I used a lot of water.
Okay.
I said a good thing. I saved the water here.
Very good. Okay. Okay, so there we go.
Sadhu.
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 Very good. Okay.